Hi everyone, Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to the Fixed Income Conversation Corner podcast series here on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. For today, we are excited to welcome back to the conversation Mike Kontopoulos, the Director of Fixed Income with Richard Bernstein Advisors, or RBA. We also have joining us today, once again, glad to welcome back Head of Taxable Fixed Income Strategy for the Americas with the UBS Chief Investment Office, Leslie Falconio. So with that, Leslie, Mike, thank you both for joining us and for spending some time today with our listeners and our clients. Leslie, I'll now pass it over to you to lead today's conversation with Mike.
Thanks, Dan. I really appreciate it. And Mike, you and I have had a lot of conversations over the past several years. I've always really enjoyed touching base with you and hearing your point of view. But I have to say, this is probably one of the more interesting times that you and I will probably speak for quite a time. And even when you think about, you know, let's just really, before we get into the nitty-gritty of what everyone wants to know in terms of vol and what's happened with interest rates, look at this, you know, entire year in terms of fixed income versus how we started the year, you know, seeing that 373 in December 23, you know, having the market price in all of these cuts, once again, as we started the year, having the removal of cuts, but still financial conditions being really loose, and frankly, fixed income overall and fixed income versus assets still doing pretty well. So what is your kind of outtake for the last few months of the year, even regardless of some of the conversations that we're going to have later on, like vol and the election?
Yeah, absolutely, Leslie. Well, first of all, thanks for having me. It is always a pleasure, and starting off with the market pricing in six cuts and removing, you know, a huge majority of those, and kind of back to pricing in quite a few cuts as we got towards the September meeting, and now pricing back out again. So it's been pretty wild. You know, as we sit back and look at the balance of 2024, you know, I think there's sort of like what I think the Fed should do versus what they will likely do. They will likely cut more this year, whether that be 25 in each meeting, whether it be 25 and skip December. You know, I'm not entirely certain, but clearly the bias of the committee driven by Chair Powell is to continue to cut. And I do have some strong thoughts about that. You know, and I do fear, and we can get into this in more detail a little later maybe, but I do fear that, you know, the Fed is mistaking, you know, cause and effect of what they view as tight monetary conditions for really just sort of coincidence. Like, I think inflation would likely have slowed regardless of what the federal funds rate or the real federal funds rate was. But again, we can kind of digress into that a little bit later. But the fact of the matter is the Fed does think that they are restrictive and need to cut more. And so I think they will as we head into the latter part of the year. If I had to guess, I would guess they, you know, they cut in November because the market's giving it to them. And I think there's a real chance that they could skip in December, which could cause some volatility in markets if you know they're still pricing in a cut in December.
Yeah, well, what's interesting about that, and you know, any fixed income investor knows, particularly those that are subject to any type of embedded interest rate risk, the Treasury market vol that we've seen this year has really just been incredibly high. We know the MOVE index has just gone to the point where we haven't seen in several years, but this constant reassessing and repricing of the fixed income markets in regards to the projected Fed path has just been a constant, you know, correction and then more cuts and correction again. You've had this divergence and convergence perpetually for over the past year. So we know that fixed income markets are forward looking. The Fed is backward looking. Look, what's your thoughts on this Treasury vol? Is there going to be a time? Does it have to be in December, January, where we actually see a little less vol in the rates market and a little bit more sort of continuity in terms of trend?
Well, so rate vol is really very, very highly correlated with the direction of interest rates. So I guess another way of answering that question, Leslie, would be, you know, do I think rates are going to continue to go up? Because if they go up, then you would expect rate vol to go up. And if they go down, you would expect rate vol to go down. You and I were talking a little bit before the start of the podcast here, and you know, I certainly think that we haven't seen the long end sell-off complete yet. I do think you could get to, you know, 4.5 or 4.75 very easily on the 10-year. If that happens, whether that be over the course of, you know, weeks or a few months, I would expect actually that rate vol and the MOVE index is a good proxy for that to continue to actually move higher. You know, and this goes back to I think, again, that sort of misperception that, you know, a very high real Fed funds rate and a level of the Fed funds rate that is, you know, much higher than some assumed neutral rate implies that we are very, very restrictive in terms of monetary policy. And one of the reasons why we've had the rate vol is because we have, as a community, as an investor base, sort of, I think, misunderstood the tightness of the monetary policy. And so what we do is we say, okay, real rates must be very, very tight, so the economy needs to slow, but then the economy is more resilient than what's expected or what maybe the real Fed funds rate or neutral rate would suggest, and then you got to price that back out. Rates go higher from a rally, and it's that constant back and forth. But at the end of the day, I think what investors maybe are missing is that monetary policy is not tight, and the traditional tools of the real Fed funds rate and, you know, where you are relative to an assumed neutral rate just don't apply that much this cycle. And that's what I think is tripping people up and ultimately leading to this yo-yo effect in treasuries. I expect that to continue.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think that at least for a while, I think we're going to have a decent amount of volatility as well. And, you know, it's been, you know, I know a lot of people, when we read some of these surveys, have just really gotten caught fairly flat-footed with that and have definitely had experience of whipsaw within this marketplace. But, like, to your point, Mike, we've been not proponents of being long the back end here. I mean, you and I were talking earlier about the fact that it was our view, whether you're bullish or bearish on rates, that we just thought that back end was going to be under some pressure, and we're seeing that, and I think we'll continue to see that. But let's go back to the Fed for a second. I mean, as we know, the Fed cut 50 basis points in September, and I'll be the first one to admit I didn't think that they were going to do it. I thought that I thought they should have gone just 25. But, you know, as we saw from that meeting, right, even though they came out with this really strong stance out of the gate, actually interest rates rose because you had all those, you know, inflation and growth vigilantes, if you will, a little bit concerned, and interest rates actually ended up rising versus coming down. But when we look into the rest of the year, and particularly the balance of 2025, because from our perspective, whether they go 25 or 50 this year really doesn't matter too much as much to us, but that 2025 path does. So how do you see this kind of playing out?
Clearly it's going to depend on the growth and inflation outlook, which is incredibly hard to forecast. I mean, a couple of things that I think are likely to happen next year, which give us some insight into the rate path, are the following. One is we likely hit an earnings peak around Q1 next year. So I think something that has been understated and underappreciated is that earnings growth of corporate America has been very, very healthy. And as a consequence, right, labor has been very, very healthy. Consumer spending has been very, very healthy. CapEx has been very healthy. And so all of these things help to drive the economy and then ultimately, obviously, this sort of range-bound to higher rate environment that we've been in. That starts to slow as you look out later into 2025. Now, how much does it slow? You know, I'm not sure we have, you know, conviction on yet, but it does seem as though earnings growth may be peaking around Q1. And so I think if earnings growth slows meaningfully as you look out in the back half of 2025, a lot of the underlying reasons for a strengthening economy may begin to go away. You also have a situation as you get into early next year, you know, inflation may not come down quite as fast as people expect just because, on a year-over-year basis, just because of your comp effect. And that's why I think as you head into 2025, you know, you're looking at higher long-term rates rather than lower. But as you look further out into 2025, as earnings growth slows and maybe the comps get a little bit easier on an inflation front, you could actually see a meaningful decline in treasury yields as we get later into next year. And so I think you start the year high in yields, kind of a little bit of a reverse of what 2024 was. You start the year higher in yields, and by the end of 2025, you probably have a nice rally in treasuries yielding a pretty good total return. But, of course, that can change just depending on the macro outlook, inflation, and fiscal policy, et cetera. So we'll kind of have to wait and see. But 2025 may be the year that people were expecting in 2024.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point as well. I mean, I always find it interesting. I mean, this year in 2024, in the beginning, you actually reversed part of that rally that we saw at the tail end of 23 simply because inflation came out actually stronger, right? When you think about what happened
in the
quarter of this year. But the interesting part was as inflation came out stronger and yields rose, risk assets like did incredibly well, which is something that didn't happen in 2023. And I think that was just based on the expectation that, look, the Fed is, you know, going to cut at some point. And I think that dialogue and I think that expectation is going to be an important part into 2025 as well. But as we head towards, you know, a very important part of next year, right? We're looking at, you know, the election in terms of policy and policy implementation. How are you viewing like the election and its impact on fixed income with it only, you know, 1 week away? We know that you've had this sort of move in rates higher because, as you mentioned, growth has been stronger. There's no question. You even had inflation a little bit stronger. And we've seen that in the rise in real yields, but there's also this part that, you know, they're front running a little bit, this election outcome. So how do you think this you know, plays out in terms of implications for fixed income?
Well, so we're of the belief that the election doesn't matter as much as people, you know, want it to matter. That's both for fixed income and for equities. I mean, at the heart of it, both, President Trump and Vice President Harris, their agendas leave us in the same spot, I think, from a deficit perspective, a spending point of view. Just one's going to get there through more tax cuts, another one's going to get us there through more fiscal spending, and so I think at the end of the day, whoever is president, I think neither of them have shown really fiscal restraint. Any sort of willingness to, try to balance the budget at all. And so I don't think it ultimately matters in the longer run, medium to longer run. I think shorter term, president, and I think the market has sort of shown this. If you look at like predicted and some of the betting markets that have shown an odds of a Trump presidency increased, rates have increased coinciding with that. I don't think that's the only reason why rates have gone up, but I think it might be part of the reason why rates are going up. And that could be because his policies, from the market's perspective, may be viewed more inflationary. But ultimately, I just don't think, either are that different, where over medium to long-term horizon, you're going to see a meaningfully different impact from whoever wins. Although short-term, maybe Trump continues to be a little bit more detrimental to bond yields just because of the inflationary impact of some of his foreign policies.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. And we know, like, when we think about that kind of outcome, because it's been such a major headline risk that all bond investors have, read about for such a long time. And I actually, for me professionally, I have a tendency to push against it. But listen, we know, to your point, neither of them are actually fiscally responsible. But when we think about the size of the deficit and that delta that each of them have on there, it's very small, especially over a long-term horizon. But with that said, you and I both know that this whole supply issue, right, that we've read about over and over and over again, is on constantly in popular media, constantly, makes bond investors somewhat nervous in terms of how much, supply could come into the marketplace, in terms of paying for the deficit. And that's one of the headwinds that we see sort of in terms of, the whole yields rising, even though we think it's secondary to growth and secondary to inflation. We call it like a passenger, not a driver. But what kind of notable headwinds, that people should be mindful of fixed income, say, over the next year?
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head there. I would also argue that there are some secular challenges to owning, the long end of the yield curve. They're not just cyclical. The debt overhang and there's a lot of other reasons as well, whether it be deglobalization, real shift in our workforce, lack of commodity and infrastructure spending for the last several decades. There's lots of different reasons to expect long-term treasury yields to be challenged over the coming, not only year, but 5 years or even 10 years. But you can't let the secular get in the way of the cyclical, right? The biggest headwind to treasuries over the next 12 months, would be, quite frankly, just a stronger growth environment, right? It would be one where the economy continues to chug along, and it's a very plausible scenario. The consumer has been very, very resilient, and really you've had sort of alternating consumer slowdowns, manufacturing slowdowns, and the two haven't really been in sync yet since COVID. You haven't really had a year where the consumer and manufacturing has slowed, nor really have you really had a year where consumer and manufacturing has accelerated. And, you know, you could envision a world in 2025 where both the manufacturing side of the economy and the consumer side of the economy are quite healthy and are in sync. And if that were to happen, then, you know, you may end up pricing, not only pricing out cuts, but start pricing in more more tightening of policy at some point. And that would obviously have a meaningful impact to Treasury yields. And so I think growth side on a cyclical one-year horizon is the biggest factor, the biggest potential risk that you have to the Treasury market. But I do think there are secular challenges that, you know, investors should keep in mind in terms of thinking about how do we invest in a landscape where maybe structurally we have higher yields. What does that mean for owning fixed versus floating, for example, securitized product versus, you know, more traditional, you know, fixed rate, you know, corporate debt, for example. So there's bigger implications to fixed income investing in our view.
Yeah, I mean, Mike, you and I have talked, you know, before about, listen, we've had, if the rise in interest rates is growth driven, then you still have that negative correlation between interest rates rising and, say, in spreads, right? Spreads will compress. But to your point, as we saw in 2023, once that becomes, you know, whether it's an actual experience point of concern or just a sentiment concern that inflation's on the rise, we saw what happened in 2023, right? You know, that rise in rates due to inflation was not beneficial to risk assets. And I just want to get your take, because I know you and I have talked about this before in terms of the amount of carry that investors are earning via risk assets, even though a majority of it is through the level of rates, given how tight spreads are. But, like, how do you see, or do you see, for example, when we have this huge money market and people still, even though the curve is not as, maybe a 3-month tenure is, but a lot of this, the two basic two stems are not inverted anymore, where do you see sort of like the allocation coming out of money market? And how do you see, how are you positioned yourself in terms of allocation within fixed income?
Yeah, I mean, you're spot on with regard to spread product. You know, as spreads compress, you're getting the majority of your return through the interest rate component rather than the credit risk component. So take, you know, sort of run-of-the-mill fixed rate investment grade credit, you know, corporate credit. Currently, the spread is roughly 80 basis points. So at this point, you know, your best case scenario is you're in 0.8% more than the risk-free rate, and you earn that carry of additional yield. And your worst case scenario is that a very, very small widening blows away that additional yield and potentially, you know, eliminates all your total return in the asset class. So the upside downside relative value proposition just really isn't there for something like, you know, fixed rate investment grade corporates. On the other hand, when you look at money market funds, preferred deposit, cash like instruments, you know, those rates are going down. I mean, the Fed does want to cut, right? And we have to acknowledge that the Fed wants to cut and will likely cut some more. And those rates are going to go down. And so the trick is figuring out exactly where to get some yield and maybe some spread, but in a way that doesn't leave you too much, you know, very interest rate exposed or too dependent on what the Fed does. And I think there's a good spot for that. And we've been invested in this area since 2022. So it's been coming up on 3 years now. And they're CLOs, collateralized loan obligations. The great thing about CLOs is you get corporate exposure. The underlying collateral of this securitized product is our corporate loans. So you're getting sort of the same basic fundamentals that you would get with a you know, investment grade or high yield bond portfolio. But by adding structure to that portfolio, you're also adding layers of protection without really giving up any yield. And so we've liked at points in time AAA CLOs. We've liked BBB CLOs as well. And we found that it's a good place to really kind of get out of cash and money market funds and start to allocate more towards those instruments or a portfolio that owns a significant part of their portfolio in those instruments, which is what RBA is doing within their fixed income holdings.
Do you have a preference now versus the AAA and BBB of the CLO side?
Yeah, we do. Right now, we still like BBBs. Simply because AAA, the spread has compressed so much. It's not unlike, you know, the investment grade corporate market. You still get more spread than you do in investment grade. So on a relative basis, I'd rather own AAA CLOs than, say, investment grade corporates. You can always add back the duration through treasuries. So on a relative basis, I would say AAA CLOs over investment grade or high yield credit, but I'd say BBB CLOs over AAA CLOs. And the reason why is BBB CLOs just haven't compressed as much as AAA CLOs. The default risk for a BBB CLO is almost the same as a AAA CLO. You are taking more volatility, but you can solve that through sizing in your portfolio. And you're getting significantly more yield and spread. And so we like BBBs for as long as the earnings cycle continues to accelerate. I think once the earnings cycle begins to decelerate and you actually aren't realizing really, really strong profit growth on a year-over-year basis, that's sort of your cue that maybe you should go back up in quality. But we're not there yet, and we don't think you'll be there for another couple quarters at least.
So in terms of just the overall outlook, say from now till, let's say June of 25, okay? So
yep.
We're saying, let's kind of like any final thoughts or takeaways that you want to sort of assess in terms of how people should be allocated, what potential, pockets of vulnerability that still exist that could create a meaningful headwind. And I don't mean just a 10-year yield going up 30 basis points or whatever it might be, but just that you're looking out for, that you're concerned with.
It's going to be challenging in fixed income because you're in a range-bound rate environment. Let's call it, 3.95 to 4.75 or something like that, 3.85 to 4.75. I really think you can see either side of that range depending on what happens between now and June. And you're in a very, very tight spread environment. And so when you're in those types of environments, not obvious how you really capture a lot of alpha by overweighting interest rate risk or credit risk. And so what you need to do is you have to sort of drive your return through selection, right? Where you own your interest rate risk or where you own your credit risk. And I think that's how you're going to get sort of pretty reasonable returns in fixed income and set yourself up for those big total returns later when rates fall and spreads widen and you have the opportunity to buy spread risk. And so from the selection point of view, I think, owning things like CLOs, owning things like steepeners, even agency mortgage-backed securities, which I know, Leslie, you and I have talked about in past podcasts, I still think represent pretty good value here.
So as
we think about for the next 9 months or so, I think by trying to get your return through very targeted and allocated selection, trying to find sort of what areas of the market are going to do reasonably well in a reasonably strong economic environment, but not set you up for losses should that growth environment roll over. You are later in the economic cycle. I mean, that's the trick. And there are places, agency mortgages, CLOs, steepeners, and then you can kind of make your money there before you get the big allocation decision later, which is to, hey, just overweight interest rate risk and then overweight credit risk. We just don't think there's a real opportunity to do either one of those at the moment.
Right. Okay, well, listen, Mike, as always, I mean, this was a very timely and a very informative conversation, as it always is. And I look forward to having you on again soon when we have a little bit more tangible results and so we can have a really even greater topic of conversation. So thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliates. The views and opinions expressed in this material by external guest speakers are those of the author, speaker, and are not those of UBS, its subsidiaries, or affiliates. Accordingly, UBS does not accept any liability over the content of this material or any claims, losses, or damages arising from the use or reliance of all or any part thereof. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient, and is published for informational purposes only. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.